Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Well, speaking of pretty brave people, we have our contemporary issues class back. So welcome back after the summer, your summer vacation. And it is like, it feels like fall out there. So that's lovely. Although it's very clear at my house, fall does not begin until September 21st. So we have negotiations sometimes over what the weather is allowed to be today. Turns out the weather is going to be whatever the weather's going to be. So what do you do? We have a little three-week series to start us out this fall for Contemporary Issues on fact and falsehood in the news.
Cool.
So our topics are based on ideas that you submitted last spring. And so ideas, questions, things you wanted to wrestle with. And I programmed the topics. I haven't completely perfectly programmed the topics. Marilyn always does that. She always sits with her back to the TV.
Slow learner.
I programmed the topics partly with an awareness that we live in caucus land. And so we're going to be thinking a little bit around politics this fall, not to tell you whom to caucus for, but to recognize that as Christians, part of our calling in the world is to be responsible to the common good. So we are responsible to the common good in the life of the congregation. We're also responsible. Welcome.
Hi.
We're also responsible to the common good in our life as citizens. Which is to say that even though we have like these really entrenched rules about not talking about money, politics, or religion, the politics part matters even in context of religion. So I want to have some conversations about kind of things that matter without telling you whom to vote for, because that's not what I'm here for. We're going to talk later in the fall, in the official fall, about activism. That was a question that that came up as you were submitting topics last spring as well. And so activism is like making public statements to try to sort of change the public conversation, and particularly to change decisions that get made at official levels. I don't want to talk about that today. Today and this month, I want to talk less about addressing elected officials and more about addressing our neighbors and having conversations with the others that we share this polis with. So not to change minds so much as to build bridges. I think a lot of the bridges have been burned and we have some rebuilding to do. So the premise of this next 3 weeks is that our politics is broken in a particular kind of way. It's broken in several different ways, probably. But one particular way in which our politics is broken is that we functionally don't live in the same reality. It is not clear, when we disagree with each other, what it is we are in fact disagreeing about. If we talk about a response to global climate change, it's not clear that we are talking between folks who all believe global climate change is a thing that's happening. If we are arguing about how we should respond to international threats, it's not clear that we are talking about the same international landscape. Now, there is an international landscape. It's not clear that we are talking about it from even compatible vantage points. it's not clear that we have the same set of facts in front of us. And so you probably, as I laid out a couple of the places where we may disagree with each other about what the facts are, you probably have opinions about which reality is false. The problem is, yours is too. So it's really easy to say, oh, those other people who watch the other cable news channel are the ones whose reality is false and filled with lies, but surely mine is correct. In reality, yes, theirs is false and filled with lies, and so is mine. So what do we do about that? We're going to watch a TED Talk today, which are, I use them because they're like 20-minute sort of here's a thing that we can discuss. This is titled, How to See Past Your Own Perspective and Find Truth. How to See Past Your Own Perspective and Find Truth. And this is by a philosopher, Michael Patrick Lynch, and the talk was given in 2017. It can be important to date your TED Talks because when you're talking especially about current events or current technology, technology has changed a lot. Current events change like by the minute. So this is about a year and a half, 2 years old. Two or more years old. I forget what half of the year we were in. Lynch is going to be talking about news and information consumption in the smartphone age, when we all walk around with the entire body of human knowledge in our pockets. Particularly, how do we consume news and information in a way that lets us functionally believe that we live in a common reality? He's going to give us that as sort of a premise, but he's going to talk about how hard it is to actually act on the premise that we live in a common reality. He's going to say that we have to believe in truth. We have to believe there is, in fact, truth out there. We have to do the work of determining what the truth is. We have to do the work of determining what the truth is. And we have to practice the humility to allow that we might be wrong. So here is Michael Patrick Lynch.
So imagine that you had your smartphone miniaturized and hooked up directly to your brain. Now, if you had this sort of brain chip, be able to upload and download to the internet at the speed of thought. Accessing social media or Wikipedia would be a lot like, well, from the inside at least, like consulting your own memory. Would be as easy and as intimate as thinking. But would it make it easier for you to know what's true? Just because a way of accessing information is faster doesn't mean it's more reliable, of course, and it doesn't mean that we would all interpret it the same way. And it doesn't mean that you would be any better at evaluating it. In fact, it might even be worse because, you know, more data, less time for evaluation. You know, something like this is already happening to us right now. We already carry a world of information around in our pockets. But it seems as if the more information that we share and access online, the more difficult it can be for us to tell the difference between what's real and what's fake. It's as if we know more, but understand less. Now, you know, it's a feature of modern life, I suppose, that large swaths of the public live in isolated information bubbles. You know, we're polarized, not just over values, but over the facts. And one reason for that is that the data analytics that drive the internet get us not just more information, but more of the information that we want. Our online life is personalized. Everything from the ads we read to the news that comes down our Facebook feed is tailored to satisfy our preferences. And so while we get more information, a lot of that information ends up reflecting ourselves as much as it does reality. It ends up, I suppose, inflating our bubbles rather than bursting them. And so maybe it's no surprise that we're in a situation, a paradoxical situation, of thinking that we know so much more and yet not agreeing on what it is we know. So how are we going to solve this problem of knowledge polarization? Well, one obvious, tactic is to try to fix our technology, to redesign our digital platforms so as to make them less susceptible to polarization. And I'm happy to report that many smart people at Google and Facebook are working on just that. And these projects are vital. And I think that fixing technology is obviously really important, but I don't think that technology alone, fixing it, is going to solve the problem of knowledge polarization. I don't think that, because I don't think at the end of the day it is a technological problem. I think it's a human problem, having to do with how we think and what we value. In order to solve it, I think we're going to need help. We're going to need help from psychology and political science, but we're also going to need help, I think, from philosophy. Because to solve the problem of knowledge polarization, we're going to need to reconnect with one fundamental philosophical idea, that we live in a common reality. Now, the idea of a common reality is, like, I suppose, a lot of philosophical concepts, easy to state, but mysteriously difficult to put into practice. To really accept it, I think we need to do three things, each of which is a challenge right now. First, we need to believe in truth. You might have noticed that our culture is having something of a troubled relationship with that concept right now. You know, it seems as if we disagree so much that, as one political commentator put it not long ago, it's as if there are no facts anymore. But that thought is actually an expression of a sort of seductive line of argument that's in the air. And it goes like this. We just can't step outside of our own perspectives. We can't step outside of our biases. Every time we try, we just get more information from our perspective. So, this line of thought goes, we might as well admit that objective truth is an illusion, or it doesn't matter, because either we'll never know what it is, or it doesn't exist in the first place. Now, that's not a new philosophical thought, skepticism about truth. And during the end of the last century, as some of you know, it was very popular in certain academic circles. But it really goes back all the way to the Greek philosopher Protagoras, if not farther back. Protagoras said that objective truth was an illusion because man is the measure of all things. Man is the measure of all things. That can seem like a bracing bit of real politics to people, or liberating, because it allows each of us to discover or make our own truth. But actually, I think it's a bit of self-serving rationalization disguised as philosophy. It confuses the difficulty of being certain with the impossibility of truth. I mean, look, of course it's difficult to be certain about anything. We might all be living in the Matrix. You might have a brain chip in your head feeding you all the wrong information. But in practice, we do agree on all sorts of facts. We agree that bullets can kill people. We agree that you can't flap your arms and fly. We agree, or we should, that there is an external reality, and ignoring it can get you hurt. Nonetheless, skepticism about truth can be tempting because it allows us to rationalize away our own biases. When we do that, we're sort of like the guy in the movie who knew he was living in the Matrix, but decided he liked it there anyway. After all, getting what you want feels good. Being right all the time feels good. So often it's easier for us to wrap ourselves in our cozy information bubbles, live in bad faith, and take those bubbles as the measure of reality. An example, I think, of how this bad faith gets into our action is our reaction to the phenomenon of fake news. the fake news that spread on the internet during the American presidential election of 2016 was designed to feed into our biases, designed to inflate our bubbles. But what was really striking about it was not just that it fooled so many people. What was really striking to me about fake news, the phenomenon, is how quickly it itself became the subject of knowledge polarization. So much so that the very term fake news now just means news story I don't like. That's an example of the bad faith towards the truth that I'm talking about. But the really, I think, dangerous thing about skepticism with regard to truth is that it leads to despotism. Man is the measure of all things, inevitably becomes the man is the measure of all things. Just as, you know, every man for himself always seems to turn out to be only the strong survive. At the end of Orwell's 1984, the thought policeman O'Brien is torturing the protagonist, Winston Smith, into believing 2 + 2 = 5. What O'Brien says is the point is that he wants to convince Smith that whatever the party says is the truth, and the truth is whatever the party says. And what O'Brien knows is that once this thought is accepted, critical dissent is impossible. You can't speak truth to power if the power speaks truth by definition. Okay, so I said that in order to accept that we really live in a common reality, we have to do three things. The first thing is to believe in truth. The second thing could be summed up by the Latin phrase that Kant took as the motto for the Enlightenment: sapere aude, or dare to know. Or as Kant glossed it, dare to know for yourself. Now, I think in the early days of the internet, a lot of us thought that information technology was always going to make it easier for us to know for ourselves. And of course, in many ways, it has. But as the internet has become more and more a part of our lives, our reliance on it, our use of it, has become often more passive. Much of what we know today, we Google now. We download pre-packaged sets of facts and sort of shuffle them along the assembly line of social media. Now, Google knowing is useful precisely because it involves a sort of intellectual outsourcing. We offload our effort onto a network of others and algorithms. And that allows us, of course, to not clutter our minds with all sorts of facts. We can just download them when we need them, and that's awesome. But there's a difference between downloading a set of facts and really understanding how or why those facts are as they are. Understanding why a particular disease spreads, or how a mathematical proof works, or why your friend is depressed, involves more than just downloading. It's going to require, most likely, doing some work for yourself, having a little creative insight, using your imagination, getting out into the field, doing the experiment, working through the proof, talking to someone. Now, I'm not saying, of course, that we should stop Google now. I'm just saying we shouldn't overvalue it either. We need to find ways of encouraging forms of knowing that are more active and don't always involve passing off our effort into our bubble. Because the thing about Google knowing is that too often it ends up being bubble knowing. And bubble knowing means always being right. But daring to know, daring to understand, means risking the possibility that you could be wrong. It means risking the possibility that what you want and what's true are different things. Which brings me to the third thing that I think we need to do if we want to accept that we live in a common reality. That third thing is, have a little humility. By humility here, I mean epistemic humility, which means just, in a sense, knowing that you don't know it all. But it also means something more than that. It means seeing your worldview as open to improvement by the evidence and experience of others. Seeing your worldview as open to improvement by the evidence and experience of others. That's more than just being open to change. It's more than just being open to self-improvement. It means seeing your knowledge as capable of enhancing or being enriched by what others contribute. That's part of what it's involved in recognizing that there's a common reality that you too are responsible to. Now, I don't think it's much of a stretch to say that our society is not particularly great at enhancing or encouraging that sort of humility. I mean, that's partly because, well, we tend to confuse arrogance and confidence. And it's partly because, well, you know, arrogance is just easier. It's just easier to think of yourself as knowing it all. It's just easier as thinking of yourself as having it all figured out. But that's another example of the bad faith towards the truth that I've been talking about. So the concept of a common reality, like a lot of philosophical concepts, can seem so obvious that we can look right past it and forget why it's important. Democracies can't function if their citizens don't strive, at least some of the time, to inhabit a common space, a space where they can pass ideas back and forth when, and especially when, they disagree. But you can't strive to inhabit that space if you don't already accept that you live in the same reality. To accept that, we've got to believe in truth. We've got to encourage more active ways of knowing. And we've got to have the humility to realize that we're not the measure of all things. We may yet one day realize the vision of having the internet in our brains. But if we want that to be liberating and not terrifying, if we wanted to expand our understanding and not just our passive knowing, we need to remember that our perspectives, as wondrous, as beautiful as they are just that, perspectives on one reality. Thank you.
He didn't have it.
We're in a situation, a paradoxical situation of thinking that we know so much more and yet not agreeing on what it is we know. And as Lynch says, that's not just a technological problem, it's a philosophical problem. It's not just a matter of getting the machines to give us better information, but it's a matter of getting us to actually find the information that leads us to truth. So he said there's this one philosophical idea that we live in a common reality, and that's harder to do than it is to say. So we have to, practically speaking, believe that there is truth and that it's not just what I or my party happen to like. We have to do the work to find out for ourselves, to understand for ourselves, and we have to practice epistemic humility, which is knowing that we don't know it all. And what I really loved was the way he brought this to the purpose of this is not to create agreement, but to actually create the conditions for disagreement. That disagreement matters for democracy. Disagreement matters for our work together as human beings. That's a Presbyterian concept as much as it is a political concept. And the problem is that what we need to disagree about is values and priorities, but we need to know in order to do that that we occupy a common reality. So, what do you find compelling about Dr. Lynch's argument?
Well, I majored in philosophy.
One of those.
And even though it is part and parcel of my life, the philosophy that I've known, that I know that I use the most in my life is that I'm the first to agree that I'm not always right, but I'm always sure. There's the problem.
There's the problem.
There's the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. And we'll come back to that. The knowledge that we are sure, alongside the knowledge that we are not always right. I think that's where the rub is, right? What else did you find compelling about the argument here?
Oh, I like that part about dare to know. That's that takes a lot of courage on a person.
Mm.
To, you know, you look back on our denomination and the arguments and the schisms that we have brought upon ourselves. You know, you just, I don't think we've taken the time to enter into dialogue with one another about the values that we hold.
Yeah, all right.
The thing that I was glad to hear from somebody that's smarter than me is people with these handheld, whatever you want to call them, multi-purpose devices, I think don't have much general knowledge. As when we went to one-room country schools, there was memorization, and we had retained some facts up here. Nobody has the urgency to have their own knowledge base because they know they got it here. And that's going to come back to haunt us, I think. This, and I first saw it in distance learning. Getting away from an instructor and classmates having discussion. Thank God I could retire at DMAC before I was forced into teaching online classes. I like the old Greek method where there was no paper or pen, it was all oral. Had to remember what the professor was saying. And I think that, and then throw in this handheld device, the students love online classes. The administration loves it. Most of the instructors love it. See, and I'm just watching this drastic change in education. And I'm not saying technology doesn't have its place, but when he made the comment that whatever you pull up is accurate, that's the facts.
There's the problem.
Without any background, what are the credentials for these experts? I'm an expert.
Yeah, but you don't know.
That's
you
what I'm saying.
Something and you don't know what and who it is that.
But they, right. They believe it is gospel,
right? And so there's a there's been some work done around actually sort of tracking the difference in how you think when you've got the information ready to hand. It's the difference between a closed book exam and an open book exam, right? And with your smartphone in your pocket, the world is an open book exam. You can still fail an open book exam, can't you?
If I wrote the exam, you could.
And how would a person fail an open book exam in your class?
It would be on topics that were discussed that they didn't think they needed to be in class that day.
Uh-huh.
I don't need to reread the book to them.
Uh-huh. So what are you doing in class that goes beyond rereading the book?
Oh, my. An author is an overrated expert. We needed to get this down to people that are working. What is it at Meredith, the policy? What is the policy out at Pioneer?
Uh-huh.
Not some geek that wrote this textbook for a financial reward. I want to know what's in Des Moines, Iowa, greater Des Moines. And that's why I love teaching night classes, because the student body was usually people that have been working. It's not just regurgitating the author's book and his requested discussion questions.
So what is it?
Well, I'm using the class time for discussion, what should we say, expanding on what you students are currently encountering. Now, if you got a student that's only worked at McDonald's, his comments are more limited than a 45-year-old person that's working, you know,
right,
at principal. I expected them to have read the book. I expected them to know what the author was thinking. I'm not going to waste class time. Well, I shouldn't say that. Very much class time.
Right.
Give them back to what they had. Now I don't know if anybody's buying the hardback textbook.
Whole different conversation. But yeah. So what you're doing, what you're doing in class is you're taking the background of what was said in the book and practicing the application of that material to particular settings.
We were establishing fact is this is what it is at Pioneer. We are establishing by fact this is what it is at Principal, not just a generalization that today's modern businesses you will have X, Y, or Z. See, it was they were the experts because I'm representing Principal. I know what the principal policy on maternity leave or parental leave, you know, it got real specific.
Right.
Well, over at Pioneer, we don't have that much time off, or we don't have any of that over here at X Company B or whatever.
Right.
That would just, that's my philosophy of how to run a class. I'm not saying all the
DMACs. No,
that's why I'm not working at DMAC
right.
anymore.
Well, what I'm shooting for is to really get at what's the difference between having the data at your fingertips, whether it is on a thing you hold in your hand or just as a list of facts that you've held in your head. Now, those are two different ways of knowing, and the differences between those ways of knowing matter. But I could know what these different policies are at these different locations and not know how to either put together or operate under a different policy in another context. I'm guessing you don't want to teach me how to operate under a policy at Pioneer if I'm going to go work at some other company that was not part of the curriculum. I'm guessing you want me to know something else. I'm guessing you want me to know how policies like that get put together, or how policies like that can be used, or how to do something else in the context of those policies.
Well, just have other than one source. Maybe that's what I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. That you don't have, well, now I'm picking on companies. Maybe we better be careful here. You know,
I don't care which company's policies.
That there's multiple acceptable, mm-hmm. legal,
yeah,
programs,
yeah,
that you need to be open-minded enough to maybe know, mm-hmm. and then you just expand that. It's a procedure. It's a learning procedure,
yeah,
that you can apply to other situations,
yes,
maybe.
And that's the difference.
It's not unique for me.
No, but that's the difference. So the thing you're actually teaching is the work of applying a policy or a set of parameters, whether those are explicit or not, a way of putting together an appropriate policy in a different context. So ultimately, you don't care whether I know how the policy works at Principal, how the policy works at Pioneer, if I'm going to be working, heaven help us, in a church, right?
Yeah.
And those policies can teach me something about how those policies work at a church.
Yeah.
There are also contextual differences. The difference between knowing the facts, which even if the technology could allow me to Google know the correct facts instantly, and I would know the difference between reading on a discussion forum what somebody said Pioneer's policy was and reading on Pioneer's own website what their policy was. So I can get back to the facts there. The difference between looking something up and having it in my head is really about whether I'm able to to generalize or translate or apply that fact in another context.
There's another factor in too, and that is you've got the question and you look up something on your phone or online. Mm-hmm. You need to have enough understanding to know whether or not what you see there applies to the question.
Right.
It's often said that if a politician doesn't like the question he's been asked, he'll answer
it differently.
Yeah. And that doesn't work on an open book test.
Right.
There's also the other thing that I find difficult is how do you disseminate what is the fact? For example, if you are looking at something and they say, well, don't believe everything you see and hear, or even what you read, now then where do you go?
Right.
Because there are, for example, a number of things you've seen on rerun on tape on any particular cable mm-hmm. station of something that appears to be constantly said, and then you go to the other cable station and the same tape can be run, but they pull out different facts. So now where do you go to make sure to find out which is the real fact?
Right.
I was going to warn. Suppose somebody in your class, as they're looking at the policy, says, how do I know that this is a fair and good policy? Where is the room for a discriminating look at the policy?
Fair policy is a subjective thing.
Well, I know it is, but all of us, even when we read the rules and regulations, I don't like that particular one, I'd just like to talk to somebody about that.
So, and that's the goal.
That's the goal.
So the goal is to be able to look at a policy, whether it is an employment policy or an environmental policy or a legal structure. Whatever we're talking about, the goal is to be able to look at a common set of facts and say, okay, that is what it says. That's the step we're working on figuring out how to do. What does the policy say, or what is the situation at hand? Then is that fair? And I think Lynch would agree that the goal is to be able to say exactly what you said. Well, I don't think that policy's fair. Or I do think that policy's fair, and here's why. Or that policy accounts for or does not account for this particular situation, and here's how to fairly work in context of that policy, in context of this situation, to bring those together. But how do we even know? Now, it's a little easier to know what the policy says, right? Although there's some obscurantism in legal writing, right? But it's easier to know what the policy says. It's harder to know what the context is for the reasons that Jean is pointing out. And that's whether we're talking about, whether we're talking about the environment or something a politician said or... situations like that. There's no referee for what actually happened here, right? You watch the football game and there's an unclear call and the referee, right, person with striped shirt, goes over and sticks their head under the thing and looks at the video from all these different angles and figures out what happened, right? Officially figures out what happened. Because there is a referee in that case. There is no referee in the public square. Shoot. So what do we do? How do we, as consumers of information, figure out which information is safe to consume? So think about your preferred news source. You don't have to say what it is. But your preferred news source, whether it's a cable channel, whether it's a radio station, whether it's a piece of paper, whether it is a piece of paper rendered on a screen on your smartphone, that's where mine is as it happens. Think about that preferred news source. One is like not very factual. Five is pretty reliably factual. How factual is your preferred news source? News analysis, your window on the outside world.
Mine gets a five.
Yours gets a five?
Yeah.
And how do you know that?
Probably because I agree with them.
Well,
which then is back to
the bubble.
Being right.
Yeah.
You're sure.
The only
other thing is I can say is then on the other occasion, because mine is a cable channel that mm-hmm. I watch a lot, mm-hmm. if I go to some of the other cable channels, and they are talking about the same thing,
mm-hmm.
they may be talking about, to me, a totally... I don't want to just say they're wrong, which they are, but besides
that, which they are.
But the interpretation of of what I've seen on the cable channel that I like is totally different, a little bit. And
so what are you looking for when you turn to the other cable channel?
Well, I try not to turn to the other cable channel too often.
So when you do, what are you looking for?
I'm looking for them to state why it is they are saying in the totally opposite of what I've seen on the other channel.
Okay.
How they can see it.
There. How they can justify what it is that they're saying. So, for example, when I see something on my cable channel that's talking about all of these children that are being held in cages,
mm-hmm.
versus their thing is that no, they're really not holding hundreds of children. There's only a couple. They're not really doing any of these terrible things.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, then they will say, well, it's only because all of these people are coming illegally. It's because they're breaking the law. Mm-hmm. It's because, and so therefore we are justified to mm-hmm. do this. Same thing with how, you know, people that are coming legally and standing in line, and how some of the answers, they're like, no, we can't send more judges. No, we can't send, we can't do any of these. So those kinds of things just make me.
I think that goes to the other overarching theme of the TED Talk, which was that, at least for me, that man is a measure of all things. And then individually that gets broken down even further because you are the measure of the things that you think are important. And I am the measure of the things that I think are important. And so that leads us to our different sources. Totally. One station could be manipulating information or, you know, presenting it in a way that they want people to see it. And the other stations are doing the exact same thing, but for an alternate perspective, which is how you get the realities.
Right. And so I don't want to ask you what the reality is at the border. I want to ask you, based on your cable channel and their cable channel, the big them, right? Based on what is reported on your cable channel and what is reported on their cable channel, how do you figure out what is actually going on at the border?
That's the problem. Without actually going down there, supposedly to see for yourself or any of your representatives, that right there is the problem. Where do you get, and we're back to what my original question was, mm-hmm. where do you get factual truth?
Right.
Well, PBS NewsHour has a byline, fair and balanced news. And for example, on the topic you're discussing, they had a woman from, I wish I could remember what agency, that went officially there and you have to wade through a lot of information, but she was not presenting a point of view or any judgment. She was just trying fact-finding. And maybe that is another bias. When someone said, this is fair and balanced, and this is what we saw, maybe that's not fair and balanced
right.
either, but you gotta start somewhere.
So you gotta start somewhere, and I will note that PBS is not the only people who say that they're fair and balanced. In fact, one of the cable channels Jean is referring to also calls themselves fair and balanced. I won't tell you which one they are.
I'm not leaving for anything personal.
No, I assumed I offended you, yeah. But what's the, again, how do you look at a source and say, what are they telling me? What are they seeing that they're not telling me? How do I know that they're seeing the thing that they are in fact telling me? This gets really hard really fast.
Or their perception to what they're seeing.
Yeah.
They're
and
seeing
then,
what they
right.
want to see.
So the perception of what you're seeing. So on the one hand, perception is, as I go there, you know, sort of what was I expecting to see, so where do I point the camera, right? And there's this is the cause for, the other cause for skepticism. As both Jean and Aaron mentioned, you can point the camera somewhere and then go back to the little dark room and we can take the same film footage and I can make it look like my person is a wonderful, glowing savior of humanity, and you can make it look like my person's a monster, right? So what do we do with the knowledge that there's, that the data that we're taking in is not necessarily as it is, right? As Jean said, you can go there yourself. I want you to just because we're at time here, I want you to just kind of chew this week on the question of, I had it written here as, I'm going to say this and then I'll restate it. I had it written here as, where would you turn for news that plausibly challenged your assumed knowledge? So when you're watching your cable channel and turn to the other cable channel to try to get some sense of what you're missing over here, that's one way of doing this, right? And I'm not even so much interested in where you would look, but what are you looking for? What could you look for to find information, like real, actual information, that is at least as quality as the information you're already taking in, but where would you look for information that challenges the information that you are already taking in? Does that question make sense?
Rather than watching the cameras.
Right.
I feel that most of the media is presenting opinion as fact.
Yes.
Presenting opinion as fact.
We used to get news. Now we don't. We get opinions.
Yeah. And to just follow that up, most of us, except for this young lady in the corner, believe Jack Shelley, Russ Van Dyke, Walter Cronkite, and at one time even the Des Moines Register.
Oh boy.
For if a reporter had something that was fabricated, it was no, they were unemployed.
Yes.
So somehow journalism, the media, be it newspaper, radio, TV, as opposed to a threat of losing my job, it's almost like that is being encouraged because we've got 24 hour news. We got to fill 24 hours on these cables. You know, Channel 8 comes on at 4:30 in the morning till 7. I mean, you got so many hours that they've got to put something in.
So what we had when we had Jack Shelley and what's his name, Van Dyke?
Russ Van Dyke,
thank you. Walter Cronkite. Even Once Upon a Time, the Des Moines Register. what we had, when we had Walter Cronkite, I mean, there's, in my memory of the hoary mists of time, Walter Cronkite is like the figure. What we had, and he may as well have been wearing a striped shirt, was a referee. Now, does the referee always make the right call?
Not always.
I enjoyed football and baseball when I could be right.
When I could be right. When you could watch at home, and the referee would make a call, and you'd say, "What are you doing?" But he couldn't stick his head under the hood and figure out what's actually going on. So what we had when we had Walter Cronkite was a referee. He was the referee we had. I am unwilling to say that he got the calls right every time. No. And I would go so far as to say that there were probably systematic errors in the calls that he made because of his particular sort of background and location in the world, which is not to say that truth doesn't exist, but that when you get your truth through one referee, you're going to systematically miss parts of the truth that are out there. Which is going to bring us back to the question of, give me two different truths that don't line up or agree with each other, what do I do with that? That's going to be our question for next week. I have no idea what we're going to do, but it's going to be great.
even when you have the referee putting his head in the hood and looking at it 20 times in how many different directions, sometimes they still can't decide. They just have to go with whatever it was called.
So right. Yeah.
Sometimes you just can't get to the truth.
Right. All right. We will see you next week.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.